Okay, when I get to 10 minutes, hit me. Okay. All right. This book is a collection of essays that I've published over the past 30 years. And initially, this project grew out of my dissatisfaction with both the mainstream and Marxist historiography of the origins and impact of the U.S. Civil War. For those of you who have any familiarity with American historiography, the last really significant attempt at a synthetic social explanation of the Civil War were those of Charles and Mary Beard, which posited a sort of timeless conflict between what they described as the agricultural interests, in which they collapsed both slaveholding planters and family farmers, and business, merchants, industrialists, etc. In the 30s and 40s, a series of important factual and empirical criticisms were made that basically undermined that historical synthesis, and it was replaced basically by two non-social interpretations of the war. One associated with the so-called revisionists like Avery Craven, which saw the war as a result of a blundering generation of demagogic politicians, and then the new, what is called the new political history associated with Michael Holt and others, which argued that the emergence of ethno-religious conflicts around Irish Catholic immigration in the 1840s and 50s destroyed the bisectional Whig and Democratic parties and opened the road to war. The Marxist historiography was equally problematic, and in fact, some ways more problematic. Prior to the 1970s, most of the Marxian historiography, which was associated with one or another organized current on the U.S. far left, essentially relied on the Beard's interpretation of the Civil War. And that literature is filled with notions of a so-called incomplete bourgeois revolution. After the 1970s, with the new left historians, people like Foner, et cetera, coming to prominence, there was a shift away from a sort of Beardian analysis, but greater emphasis, explanatory emphasis on the political and ideological, but not economic incompatibility of slavery and capitalism in the United States in the 1840s and 50s. I recognize that moving beyond the problems of the existing historiography would require a both theoretically rigorous and a historically specific analysis of what my editors imposed as a title, The American Road to Capitalism. Now, I was fortunate when I began this work in the late 1970s and early 1980s that I was sort of beginning to grapple with this at a period when there was two important intellectual developments. One was the revival of the classic Marxist debates on the origins of capitalism in Europe, initiated by Emmanuel Wallerstein's The Modern World System and continued and deepened by Robert Brenner's work, both his article in Past and Present and his, what I think is, you know, devastating critique of Wallerstein, Sweezy et al. In New Left Review. And it was particularly the framework that Brenner and then later elaborated by Ellen Makesons Wood, so-called political Marxism, that provided me with a set of fairly sophisticated theoretical tools. On the other hand, there was also a growth of a new empirical historiography of U.S. economic and political development in the antebellum period. There's the work of Michael Merrill, Christopher Clark, Winifred Rothenberg on Northern agriculture, the work of Genovese, Oakes, Fogel, and Engerman, and others on plantation slavery, and the work of Eric Foner, David Montgomery, John Ashworth, and Sven Becker's work on U.S. politics in the 1840s and 50s. And my hope was that this book, this collection of essays, would contribute both to a defense and elaboration of Marxism, a defense of Marxism in that, contrary to what is the sort of fashionable postmodernist and various idealist theories that affect what passes for a intellectual left in the academy, a defense of the notion that, in fact, social property relations, class relations, determine patterns of economic development and create the matrix in which political and ideological conflict takes place. In particular, it's also an elaboration of the so-called political Marxist framework, which rests on a rejection of teleological narratives of the transhistoric growth of productive forces or market production, that posits the centrality of social property relations with strong rules of reproduction, and posits that the transition from one form of social labor to another depends on, in the sense, the random and unpredictable outcomes of class conflict. And finally, just try to provide a specific analysis, the specific path to capitalism in the U.S. that could provide a more rigorous basis for a new social interpretation of the war and Reconstruction. And what I want to do is just very, very, in a very superficial way, talk about what my basic thesis was in this collection of essays. And I start with what is essentially the paradox of British North American colonialism. British colonialism in the 17th and 18th century was the first colonial project driven by the dynamics of specifically capitalist production in the first capitalist nation, England. But on the one hand, but on the other, the British were unable, and the British settlers, after violently expropriating the Native Americans, were unable in either the North or South to establish capitalist social property relations. In the North, we see the emergence of household-based production that where householders are able to gain access to land outside of the market and are thus able to pursue all the sort of survival strategies that we associate with classical peasantries throughout the last couple of millennia. In the South, we see the development of plantation slavery, a form of production that is embedded in and subject to the dictates of a growing capitalist world market, but is based on specifically non-capitalist relations in the production process. The American Revolution, whose roots lie in the struggle of merchants, subsistence farmers, slave-owning planters, urban artisans, to reproduce themselves essentially as non-capitalist classes independently of Britain, has the unintended consequence in the constitutional settlement of 1787 of constructing a state that for the first time in the history of North America is actually able to begin to enforce legal title to land throughout what becomes the United States. While the imposition of what Marx calls a social monopoly of land in the U.S. does not alter the master-slave property relation in the South and actually promotes it, it does fundamentally alter Northern agriculture, making the obtaining, maintaining, and expanding of landed property dependent on successful market competition. And my argument is that starting around 1800, after the defeat of household producers in a series of revolts, the most well-known being Shays Rebellion, Whiskey Rebellion, Freeze Rebellion, etc., we see a shift from independent household production, peasant production, to what I call petty commodity production, a form of household-based production that is subject to market coercion. And that this process is completed in the late 1830s with the massive commodification of land through waves of land speculation fueled by the public land system that's established around 1805, 1806. The subordination of these northern household producers to the dictates of the market creates a growing home market for industrial capital. It forces them to specialize, to innovate, to accumulate. This then provides a growing home market for both consumer goods, but in particular in the U.S., for capital goods and for industries that will process the products of agriculture, meat packing, flour milling, etc., that allows for the emergence, particularly after 1840, of a growing manufacturing and industrial capital. The subordination, I argue on a sort of overall framework of in the U.S., the subordination of northern household producers to market forces creates this growing home market and fundamentally transforms the structure of the U.S. economy. It is no longer merchants, either the transatlantic merchants exporting cotton or the thousands of small, medium, and large land speculators, transport infrastructure speculators, et cetera, who bind together the U.S. economy. Instead, it is the growing interaction between capitalist manufacturing and what can be called petty bourgeois, petty capitalist agriculture in the West. As you get this shift from the merchants binding the economy together to manufacturers binding the economy together, you get this radically alters the place of plantation slavery in the growth and development of the U.S. economy. As I argue in the book in some detail, this non-capitalist form created and dependent on the capitalist world market was non-capitalist not because slaves were unfree and lacked motivation to work hard, et cetera, like free wage laborers, which idealizes wage labor, in my opinion, but instead because under slavery, the planters buy not the labor power, the ability to work of the slaves, but the laborer themselves. Thus, the work slaves enter the production process as a form of fixed capital, which creates blockages to particularly technical innovation and to specialization. It leads to the basically stagnant technology that we see in the plantation South through from the 1820s on, once cotton is consolidated. And it leads to the almost universal tendency in all of the slave societies of the New World towards plantation self-sufficiency. As a result, there's a very shallow division, social division of labor in the South, limited industrialization, and that the only way, I argue, that the plantocracy can respond to market dictates, the world market for cotton, is through geographic expansion, the multiplication of the number of slaves and land. Before 1840, I argue, exports of slave-produced cotton allow for a favorable balance of trade, and allow for the importation of money capital from both Britain and Europe, which fuels in the 1820s, 30s, waves of speculation in land and in transport infrastructure, which fuels the expansion of increasingly market-subordinated household production in the North and plantation slavery in the South. After 1840, with the activities of manufacturers becoming increasingly dominant in the U.S. economy, the geographic expansion of slavery, which had fueled the expansion of commodity production, the expansion of both slavery and petty commodity production, increasingly becomes an obstacle to the development of capitalism, because now the development of capitalism depends upon the continuous deepening socially and expansion geographically of specific sets of class relations associated with petty commodity production. And as I argue in detail in the book, in areas where plantation slavery is dominant, petty commodity production cannot develop. If you look at the South, while the majority of whites were not slaveholders, the ones who were not slaveholders were basically independent household producers. They basically squatted on land that the planters didn't want in the Pine Barrens and the upcountry, et cetera, and reproduced themselves outside of the marketplace. So that from, I would argue, from the 1840s on, the continued development of capitalist industry and petty capitalist agriculture and the continued development of plantation slavery, the conditions of their economic reproduction were increasingly incompatible. It is this growing incompatibility, I argue, that creates the matrix for the sectional crisis and the Civil War, the political conflicts that lead to the collapse of the so-called bisectional parties, the Whigs and the Democrats, who have been bound together under the leadership of different groups of merchant capitalists who themselves were indifferent to the class relations of commodity production, sees the emergence of a polarization between, on the one hand, a block of manufacturers, farmers, urban professionals, et cetera, around the Republican Party, and increasingly radicalized and unified planter class under the leadership of small and medium planters in the Democratic Party, and the marginalization of the forces that had traditionally been associated with compromise, the merchant-led Whigs and Northern Democrats. This political polarization culminates in secession and war. And then in the concluding chapter of the book, I look at the period of Reconstruction and how we can sort of understand the Civil War and Reconstruction as, in a very limited sense, a bourgeois revolution, but certainly not a bourgeois democratic revolution in any sense. I've babbled on long enough. I'll let people who know more talk now. Thanks.